In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about drugs and the making of the modern world. That's the subtitle of a book that we'll be talking about. The title is Forces of Habit. It's published by the Harvard University Press. The author, our guest, is David Courtwright. He's professor of history at the University of North Florida. It seems that for much of human history, human beings have been drawn to mood and mind-altering substances. A big change, though, in our drug use is something that we've seen perhaps in the last couple of centuries. That is, today, we and people around the world have access to a very wide array of drugs, much more so than our ancient forebears. How that happened to be, how it is that drugs that at one time were local favorites, geographically isolated, came to be worldwide commodities, one of the questions that Professor Courtwright takes up in his book and we'll be discussing this morning. And, of course, whatever questions people have who are listening, you can call in and talk with our guest. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and we will pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL. That's what you get when you match the numbers and the letters. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Courtwright, hello. Thanks for talking with us today.
You're quite welcome.
We appreciate it. I'm just curious how it is you, because I know that you've done a lot of writing on this subject, how it is you became interested in mind and mood-altering substances and why and how people use them.
Well, the inspiration for this particular book came when I was standing in a duty-free shop in an airport about 10 years ago. And if you've ever been in a duty-free shop, you've probably had the same insight, namely, you're completely surrounded by drugs. There were Marlboro cartons to my right, and there were Drambuie bottles to my left, and straight ahead against the wall were coffee beans from Kenya. And aside from perfumes and a few other things, most of the products that were available for sale in this duty-free shop were psychoactive. And I asked myself a simple question, which was, where did all this stuff come from? Because, you know, most duty-free shops everywhere in the world are the same. They offer pretty much the same range of psychoactive products. Mm-hmm. So I started playing with this, and I came to realize, if you go back far enough in time, most of these products were isolated. Coffee, for example, existed only in one place, in Ethiopia, and gradually spread to Arabia, and from Arabia to Europe, and from Europe to the New World. And eventually, 70% of the world's coffee beans were produced in the Western Hemisphere. And you can tell a similar story for virtually all psychoactive products.
Mm-hmm. Well, why, then let's talk a little bit more about that. As you say, coffee started in Africa. Tobacco and coca are New World plants.
Right.
Cannabis is something that was native to India. So at one, as you say, at one point, these were, as I use the phrase I used in the beginning, they were local favorites. They were things that in particular parts of the world people used. And now, caffeine is the world's, for example, caffeine is the world's most widely used drug, something that might surprise people. How is it that something like coffee beans, for example, or tobacco ends up being something that goes from a local plant to something that is everywhere?
In a phrase, European imperial expansion. The real engine behind the global psychoactive commerce was the expansion of European colonies, and in particular the plantation system. Because if you stop and think about it, what did Europeans grow on their plantations in the New World, in India, in Africa? Basically, they grew things like tea or coffee, or they produced sugar, much of which was turned into rum, which is another drug product. And that was the real key, the fact that mercantile elites could make a lot of money from drug commerce and drug cultivation, and the governments got into the act. A really interesting part of the story is how governments went from a position of initial ambivalence or opposition to making money like mad off of these products. So that, for example, by the late 19th century, half of the income of the British government was coming from taxes on various psychoactive products.
Hmm. It's also interesting that in that respect, that so many, if not all of these things, so many of these things began as medicines and had relatively restricted kind of use, and that when they were used that way, governments maybe weren't paying all that much attention. And it was only when they broke out of that medicinal use to widespread, what we might say, recreational use, did governments actually start taking notice and want to do things like either regulating them or finding some way that they could make money off of.
Tobacco is a really excellent example of that. Tobacco was introduced into Europe by the Spanish, and it was, for the first 25 years or so, it was basically discussed as a promising new drug. It was expensive, but it seemed to have a number of useful therapeutic applications. It's only after tobacco, and in particular tobacco smoking, becomes popular in bordellos and taverns that you get a strong reaction from European governments. And in fact, the initial law, some of them were quite draconian and involved very severe penalties for smoking. Ultimately, however, towards the end of the 17th century, virtually all European governments had capitulated, and they simply taxed the traffic in recreational tobacco use as opposed to trying to suppress it.
You have divided up drugs into, at least if you look at those that are perhaps most widespread and most frequently used, into what you call the big three and the little three.
Right.
The big three being the legal ones and the most often used, the caffeine, alcohol, and nicotine. And then little three, the things, and these, of course, will be the things that perhaps people most likely to think of when you say drug, and we use it that way, opium, cannabis, and coca. And that also leads to the interesting question, well, why is it that the big three are so widely accepted, they are all legal, and the little three are not?
Well, the question answers itself in a way. Partly it's simply that bigness confers a degree of immunity. Now, there have been some cases in history where some of the big three drugs have been briefly illegal. I mean, the classic case, of course, is alcohol prohibition in the United States in the early 20th century. But in general, those three drugs, alcohol and caffeinated foods and drinks, and tobacco products have been legal since the late 17th century. And one reason for that is that, notwithstanding the manifest harms of alcohol and tobacco, making those substances illegal would put a whole lot of people out of work. If you look at the worldwide statistics of the number of people involved in tobacco production and distribution, it runs into the tens of millions. Likewise, in countries like France, where viticulture is an extremely important industry, lots of people's livelihoods depend on these substances. So one of the reasons for the relative immunity of those particular substances is simply the scale of operations.
Hmm. I wonder, I'm sure that someone would make the argument that notwithstanding the fact we know about the hazards of alcohol abuse, now we know that nicotine is a carcinogen. Some people, I guess, might argue, and I guess they'd have to say caffeine is, you know, as long as you use it in moderate amounts, seems to be harmless. They would say, well, there is a difference in the negative effects between the two, and that we would say that use of opium and cannabis and cocaine, coca in its traditional use, may be something different, that those things are more deleterious than caffeine and, let's say, moderate alcohol use.
Yes, but not tobacco use. Tobacco, cigarettes in particular, are a deadly drug even when used as intended. And this is something that has struck me. Of the two big legal drugs that are demonstrably harmful, namely tobacco and alcohol, it seems to me that tobacco has become the one that's most controversial. And what's interesting is that very much reverses the position from the early in the century. In the 1910s or the 1920s, alcohol was the controversial drug, at least in the United States. Tobacco smoking was fairly widespread, or the use of other forms of tobacco. But now, alcohol is relatively less controversial, and tobacco is becoming much more so. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is simply the accumulation of the damning health evidence. caffeine, as you pointed out, lacks the equivalent of cirrhosis or lung cancer. And for the foreseeable future, it will remain relatively uncontroversial, even though caffeine dependence is a very real phenomenon mm-hmm. and a very widespread one.
Well, and certainly nicotine dependence is too. And if for no other reason, that makes it very difficult if one decides that you'd like people to stop using tobacco.
Yeah, let me throw something else in here. Another thing working in alcohol's favor is the growing epidemiological evidence that moderate alcohol consumption, the glass of wine with the daily meal, can in fact confer, apparently, certain kinds of health benefits. And that is not true of tobacco. There is no moderate level of tobacco use that is good for you.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Courtwright. He's professor of history at the University of North Florida. He's the author of a number of books, and we're talking about his most recent, which is Forces of Habit, Drugs and the Making of the Modern World, published by the Harvard University Press. And questions are welcome. We have a couple of people we'll get right to. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Caller first up in Taylorville, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I would, I'm afraid I have a tendency to harangue on occasion. Well, I'm going to do a little more right now. I'm not exactly proselytizing, but you have a drug, for example, cannabis, the effects of which are so outrageously conducive to certain feelings of sensuality, and trying to make it illegal and throwing people in the slam for relatively minute amounts of this stuff is not just nuts, not just wrong-headed and mean-spirited, but nuts. It's about as ridiculous as trying to get animals to stop, if you'll pardon the vernacular, getting it on. I think this civilization would be a lot more shall we say, sensible, if it focused on the ill effects of the major popular and legal drugs and put more money into prevention and treatment. And as for the more dangerous illegal drugs like cocaine, nobody's denying that, and heroin, I see no point in throwing addicts into the slam for whatever amounts they may have, or whatever they're doing to their bodies. Again, treatment is the answer.
Well, Professor Courtwright, I expect you probably would in some part agree, and then again, maybe not. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly the case that cannabis is in play as a drug right now. As I'm sure you and your listeners know, there's a lot of controversy about the legal status of cannabis and whether or not it should be used as a medicine. Let me simply say that this is true of most drugs at most points in history. It's not simply a given that there are some good legal drugs and some bad illegal drugs, but the fortunes of various drugs rise and fall. And right now, cannabis has become a kind of culture war football in the United States. Personally, I tend to think that the drug war is overdone, that it is indeed ridiculous to provide severe sanctions for a drug like cannabis. But I should say that the book itself is not a polemic. It's not a kind of, oh, this drug should be treated more severely or less severely than that drug. As an historian, it's not my business to interject my own political views. It's simply to try to offer an account of why these various substances are treated differently.
Mm. Well, maybe let me ask you this question and see what you think. It seems that the way we talk about drugs sometimes comes down to an argument, and maybe not a very productive one, but an argument between those people who think that we should approach it as a moral issue, and those people who would say, well, no, this is not a moral issue, this is a public health issue, and two different, and so depending on which of those you take, a different approach is dictated if you think that use of this drug is problematic. As one thinks about historically drug use, has that always been the case? that is wrestling between those two different ideas, that it's a moral issue, that it's a, maybe more of a public health issue.
No, that's a fine insight. And in fact, for a fairly substantial percentage of the population, moral considerations overwhelm everything else. I mean, it's simply wrong. It's sinful to do this. The government ought to suppress sinful behavior. Therefore, these drugs ought to be illegal. And they don't want to hear about cost-benefit analysis or anything else. In more general terms, there are five politically significant reasons why people oppose drugs. And the moral issues are only one subset of this five. The first is the harm that drugs do directly to individuals and others, drunk drivers, people who take years off their lives, etc. The second, and this reason has become increasingly important in the 20th century, the second big consideration is social costs. I'm sure you're familiar with arguments that people who abuse alcohol and tobacco run up all of our insurance premiums and tax bills because they use more Medicare and Medicaid services, etc. The third reason, the one you referred to, is the religious or the moral conviction that drugs are wrong, period. The fourth general reason why some drugs are illegal or strictly regulated is that they are associated with a disliked or deviant group. And going back to the previous caller's question, I think that might be one very important reason why cannabis is on that list of Schedule I controlled substances. Is historically, it has been associated with lower class blacks, with bohemians, with Latin American immigrant workers, and so on. And fifth and finally, if a drug is perceived, rightly or wrongly, to be undermining the security of the group, whether that group is defined as a nation, tribe, whatever, then it's also likely to be subject to prohibition and or severe restriction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And at one point in the book, you talk about in the section where you raise this question, why is it that particularly these six things, and maybe also one might to add other related substances like sugar and chocolate, why is it these things were embraced by Europeans as they went around the world and not other things, that it's noteworthy that substances that were used by the indigenous people of the Americas, where the Europeans were very suspicious of them, weren't apparently interested in them, maybe for a variety of reasons, but maybe the big reason was their association with those cultures, particularly with the religions of those cultures, and that Europeans didn't want to go near that.
Yeah, and in particular, psychedelic drugs. Mm-hmm. The drugs that caught on with Europeans tended to be drugs that had regular and predictable effects. Drugs like peyote, for example, were much less popular, in fact, not at all popular as items in global commerce, I think in not only because they were associated with these supposedly diabolical native rituals, but also simply because of the unpredictability of their effects.
Mm-hmm. We have some other folks to talk with. And next up, a caller in Southern Illinois. This is line number one. Hello.
How you doing? Hi. This is another wide issue of things and comments can go just about anywhere. But my view, and I've experimented with a lot of it until I've found my religion, you know, Christ. Anyway, my view is that, you know, if you was to use the same thing you said about tobacco, you know, it employs a wide number of people. Well, if you look at it this way, with drugs being illegal, then that money is going to a wide number of people who are, just taking advantage of people and everything, killing them, slaughtering them, everything. But if you was to make it legal, eventually, I mean, that money would go to people in society, you know, that might use it a little better. And eventually, these people would abuse it enough, it would shorten their lifespan. I mean, I hate to say it, but really, we don't need them around anyway. I mean, if that's what they want to do, hey, aren't we free to do anything? I mean, all we're going to do is just keep on putting a rule against the rule. And really, you need to change a man's heart. You can't change what he desires because, I mean, there's all kinds of sexual stuff with children and stuff. You just got to go ahead and just, I mean, I agree there are things we need to do. But I think that we are doing it from the wrong side of the ladder, but yet it's easy for me to say because I'm not up there dealing with it. But I think there are a lot more successful ways, but it's better for me to just keep it, I'm talking as far as the law. If I just keep the drugs illegal, well, man, look at all these big money rolls I get to confiscate, these million-dollar mansions and these luxury cars. That comes property of the state. I think is more involved in them making money off of what they get to take away. Because if I have a problem with you, it builds a wall in me. And you know, if I'm trying to hide something from you, it builds a wall between the two of us, and it causes conflict. Well, that's what's happening when these people are trying to hide the drugs and stuff that they're doing. It builds a wall between them and other people in society and causes conflict. I mean, I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, Professor Courtright, you can. I know, as you said, I think you're not your purpose really to take on the issue of whether drugs should or should not be legal, or even how, as a society, we should approach that, depending upon, you know, which way we decide we want to go. I suppose, though, some people, again, to pick up on what the caller had to say, some people would make the argument that legalization and the taxes that you could impose would, in fact, end up making you more money if that's what you thought this was really all about.
Yeah, that's actually the call leads into an interesting area. Remember, the second general consideration that I mentioned a moment ago is social costs. Mm-hmm. And one of the common arguments in favor of legalization is, oh, gosh, we could save money on police. We could tax the commerce in these psychoactive products and use the money to provide drug treatment. And it's all true. There are lots of ways you could save money. The big question, David, is whether the net social savings would be there. In other words, suppose in a legalization scenario you have less expenditure on prisons, police, etc. You save millions of dollars. But suppose also that the number of users increases, which is one very likely outcome. Each user might be costing society less than under prohibition, but because there would be more users, the total amount of harm and expense might increase. And it's really, to be honest with you, it's devilishly tricky when you look at the likely social savings and social costs under various policy scenarios to figure out what exactly would happen.
Let's go to another caller. This is Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, to go on with your discussion about social cost, it seems to me that the social cost that we confer upon other portions of the world is enormous. We criminalize the drugs here, or wherever country you might want to pick, but we criminalize the drugs here. But since the desire is here, we obviously go to another spot in the world to get most of these drugs. Not all of them, but most of them. Therefore, we institute a cost on that other culture, that other economy, that other group of people who may not even consume them. And by keeping it illegal, we are making it more costly for them to live in their world. You know, whether it's they have to have corrupt police or corrupt judicial system, or just combat the cost of drugs, period, because we supply a tremendous amount of money to these people who are actually not the people who grow it don't make the money, but the people who are doing the importation and the corruption are really making the most of the money. And those people may very well not be just crooks. They may very well be very powerful people who realize that these billions and billions of dollars would be just as good in their pocket as any poor peasant or any poor drug addict.
Well, let me comment on that in a couple of ways. First, I'm not inclined to defend U.S. drug policy.
What I'm saying is that the social cost is much larger than just the monetary cost. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a fair point. Although the other comment I wanted to make, or the other thought that was inspired by your comment, is simply that in a lot of these countries that are heavily involved in drug trafficking, these countries would have serious problems anyway. And the reason I say that is one of the things I discovered is that drug trafficking tends to flourish in countries which are divided by civil war and in which there is no strong central government. This is true. Well, actually, Colombia is a really good example because of the current political and guerrilla problems they have in that country. But if you look at China, if you look at Afghanistan, if you look at any number of nations where the drug trafficking is a big part of the political economy, what you see is that different factions in those countries are basically using the drug traffic to finance their acquisition of weapons and as a basis for their attempt to gain political control of the country. That is not something that is purely and simply a concomitant of U.S. policy. A lot of those problems were there and antedated U.S. involvement in those countries.
But that's where you exactly hit on the same thing I'm saying. The use, we're not the only people that use drugs, obviously.
Right.
All portions of the world. And since the trade in these drugs, like you say, traditionally goes to places like the Golden Triangle in Bangkok and Burma and Thailand, that area there, every one of these places is exactly like you say. The drug money supports the various nefarious actions that
it supports private armies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so all these costs are so great. Why not decriminalize it and get that portion out of it? So you would cut down on these private armies and these different things like this, the corruption of the police and the judiciary, and on and on and on. We can just continue talking about it forever, it seems like.
Well, I'm sure you've correctly identified one of the benefits of legalizing all drugs everywhere in the world is that there would be less money available for private armies to finance their guerrilla operations. That's undoubtedly true.
When I say decriminalization, I don't mean just let the dealer, you know, some drug dealer on the corner do it, but do it in a very intelligent way. Physicians and pharmacists involved in it. It seems to me a much more intelligent way.
Yeah, the buzzword that's usually just the buzzword that's commonly used to describe that policy is controlled legalization, by which is meant taxed, controlled sales, no sales to children, maybe through a physician, etc. Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to someone else here, line two in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've often wondered if the so-called legal drug companies, the big drug companies, don't have a vested interest in pressure the government to keep all the illegal drugs illegal so that they can sell their legal drugs, because the illegal drugs would take away a lot of their business. Well, how do you feel about that? It seems to me there's a fine line between legal drugs and illegal drugs. It just depends on who's selling it.
Yeah, I think it's probably the case that drug companies are more interested in keeping their legal drugs, the drugs that they already market, keeping them relatively accessible to the public. That's a bigger priority. As you may or may not know, drugs are not simply legal or illegal. The government assigns them to a schedule. Schedule 1 is absolutely prohibited. Schedule 2 is very tightly controlled. It's extremely difficult to get access. And Schedules 3, 4, and 5 basically provide more liberal access to these drugs. And there have been cases where the government, confronted with evidence of abuse and addiction, has considered increasing the degree of regulation of a pharmaceutical product, and then usually the drug companies will line up their lawyers and they'll march into the hearings and they'll present their case for why this drug should not be moved from, say, Schedule 5 to Schedule 3. They do that all the time. It's not as obvious to me that somebody who's marketing an SSRI,
SSRI?
Oh, a drug like Prozac, a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Why legalizing heroin would endanger the market for something like Prozac? I'm not sure I agree with that. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the drug companies do have rules about what they can put on the market. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yes, and they are keen on defending the status of drugs that they market, and they're very vigilant. See, one of the things that can get drug companies into trouble, and this is a major theme in the book, is something called diversion. Ethical drug companies market drugs as medicines, but the truth is that often drugs leak out of the medical distribution system, a drug like amphetamines, for example, and then people start using it for non-medical purposes. And when that happens, the government starts to get really interested in tightening up regulations. And then the pharmaceutical companies become extremely nervous because they don't want the regulations so tightened up that they're going to lose a lot of business. That's where the real conflict comes, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think that, as I suggested, that the drug companies are behind keeping the illegal drugs illegal?
I don't have any evidence for it. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's continue. And next person here would be Chicago Line 1. Hello.
Thank you. Well, one reason for not curtailing or admonishing people to further reduce alcohol and smoking and even the soft drinks is because of the high tax revenue the government obtains through the sales, which are among the highest forms of taxation revenue that the government has. What on earth would they tax if they didn't have these areas to maintain that level of revenue? And so there we have a further...
I think the caller dropped out a little there, but I think we took his point.
Yes, and I think it's an excellent point. In fact, there's a section of the book which is called Tax Addiction, which refers to the tendency of governments to become dependent upon revenues from substances like tobacco and alcohol. It's a very fine point. However, if you think about this in policy terms, you realize that, well, you know, if we really had the political will to place greater restrictions on alcohol and tobacco, we could always increase the sales tax, or we could always bump up the income tax 2 or 3%. And there are other ways that we could make up the revenue gap. I mean, it's not like we're condemned to forever have widespread commerce in these substances simply because we derive a certain percentage of the revenue.
Well, you know, given one wonders, given just how deeply embedded in our culture these, particularly the big three, are, and the fact that they do, people do develop dependencies on them, would suggest that it would be very. It makes it difficult to imagine a time when there, one maybe might imagine a time when there would be fewer people smoking, but. One can hardly imagine a time when there would be no one drinking coffee, or even where there would be no one drinking alcohol.
Yeah, that's a fair point. It's not just the economic heft of these particular industries. It's the cultural habit. In fact, I guess that's part of the point of the title of the book, Forces of Habit. The most spectacular case, I think, is actually drinking in the Soviet Union. There's a whole section of the book that deals with that as a kind of case study in the failure of not one but two attempts to drastically restrict the legal availability of alcohol. One was during the Bolshevik Revolution. Very few people know that the Bolsheviks were practically as ardent prohibitionists as their American counterparts. And then, of course, the one example that most people can immediately call to mind is that of the Gorbachev regime in the late 1980s. Both were spectacular failures. And the primary reason, as near as I can tell, is simply that among the Russians, or at least those of Slavic ethnicity, drinking is simply a cultural given. It is a very, very deep cultural habit.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Courtwright. He's professor of history at the University of North Florida and has written this book that explores drugs and the making of the modern world. It's titled Forces of Habit, and it's published by the Harvard University Press. We have some other callers. We'll just keep on here. And next in line is Mount Carmel, line number 3. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if in your book, if you touched on the impact of growing crops like coffee, the impact it has on world hunger.
Oh,
that it crowds out crops that could grow for food.
Oh, that's a great question. I do. And in fact, I was really struck by the environmental effects of drug crops. Something like 40% of the arable land of northern Latin America is given over to coffee cultivation. And not only does that mean that you're not growing wheat or corn or something else on that land, the kinds of coffee that are grown also have a major environmental impact. For example, 40 or 50 years ago, most of the coffee that was grown was shade coffee, and people would grow coffee bushes beneath avocado trees and other kinds of fruit trees, which were perfect habitats for all kinds of songbirds. But beginning, I believe, in the 1960s, a new kind of coffee, which could be grown directly in the sun, was developed. And that, for reasons of economic efficiency, that displaced a lot of the old shade-grown coffee. And so that as trees were cut down to open up these coffee fields to the sun, a lot of avian habitat was destroyed. So the point is, the closer you look, the more you get into this, the more you see that the mass cultivation of tea, coffee, tobacco, and other crops used to manufacture drugs has had profound environmental consequences.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right,
you're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Let's go next to Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Yeah, a comment and a question. The comment is that when you mentioned how a lot of people engaged in civil wars look to drug trade, you should include Reagan and Oliver North, and merely the fact that it's such a high return on investment operation or enterprise says nothing at all about whether or not it's, you know, they're right in trying to do what they're trying to do. Reagan was one of our most popular presidents, and he thought it was okay. But my question has to do a little bit more to your topic, which is the way drugs start from one spot and move on to another, more or less. And I'm hoping you know a little bit of, you know, something about a drug. I keep asking people who are on this show that talk about drugs, but even statesmen from India don't know what I'm talking about, and it's really distressing. I hope you do. Have you heard of a drug called Jivani?
No, I have not. Please enlighten me.
Oh, God. Well, you know, it brings up a whole issue, but maybe the best way to do this is just to read a paragraph from where I first heard about it. It says, scientists huffing and puffing on a trek up a mountain in southern India noticed their guides from the Kani tribe didn't look tired at all. They also noted the guides were plucking and eating berries from a plant growing on the slope. Basically, what happens is they ask one of the guides, and they find out about this plant, and it gives them a sudden burst of energy, and they don't feel hungry for several hours, and they don't feel thirsty or tired either. And anyway, they created this drug called Jivani from it in India. And the Indian tribe that is getting a royalty from it, and apparently it's totally non-addictive. And I'd be curious to know if you, to my mind, it brings up all these notions of, if in fact you had a drug that had an effect like this,
it sounds like it's really similar to cot. Cot, Q-U-A-T, pronounced cot, is a bush that grows in and around the Arabian Peninsula. The point, I don't know a lot about this particular substance, but it does lead us in an interesting direction, and that direction is this. The process of the confluence of the world's psychoactive resources is ongoing. Even though I've written a book that's a history of the last 500 years, there's no reason to suppose that the process that you've just described of discovering a new stimulant plant and how that plant might in fact become an international commodity, that whole process is still wide open. Although I would like to add one point. If this happens with Jivani, it will be the exception and not the rule, because the main engine of psychoactive novelty in the modern world is not the discovery of plants like this in remote parts of the world. It is the creation of synthetic and semi-synthetic drugs by pharmaceutical companies. That's where most of the new global drug commodities are going to come from.
Yeah, but I can't picture a pharmaceutical, for example, putting out on the label you know, this will energize you, keep you awake for hours, you know, and have no harmful effects.
Oh, sure, I can imagine that. I'm a runner, and if you go to a running store, you can buy little packages of instant energy mix. And if you actually take the trouble to read the ingredients, you'll see that 90% of the stuff that's in the package is basically caffeine from various plants that contain caffeine. But through the health food industry, and I don't mean to disagree with you, but I think that if this thing is marketed on a global basis, the most likely way that it would be done would be through something like the health food and tonic industry.
Yeah, exactly, but not the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, probably not, in part because they have literally thousands of other and probably cheaper stimulant drugs available that can be manufactured synthetically.
Well, anyway, I wanted to ask you if it brought to my mind what a lot of teenagers think about ecstasy, you know, that ecstasy... It allows them to stay up all night and dance, and they don't see any kind of negative impact to it. And I'm just curious if you happen to know of any. Now, ecstasy is strictly a synthetic drug. It's not, you know, it doesn't come from a plant at all or anything. It's not natural in any way. If you know of any other instances where there are supposedly positive psychoactive effects, but that it's still criminalized, like ecstasy. I guess I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay. Well, last comment is simply that there is no drug that has no negative effects. Even a drug that is as relatively benign as caffeine, which is a stimulant, like Giovanni. Changes brain chemistry, and this is something I want your listeners to understand. There's no free ride when it comes to drugs. It's true that some drugs are much more harmful than others, but changed brain chemistry and dependency is possible with virtually any psychoactive substance. And I'm sure that further studies of Giovanni, if it does indeed contain a powerful stimulant, would indicate as much.
We just have a couple of minutes left. We have two other callers, and we probably can't get them both, but we'll try and get at least one. Here we'll go to Crystal Lake, line four. Hello?
Yeah, hi. We have to remember the CIA introduced cocaine to the Blood and Crips gangs in California, according to San Jose Mercury in California. And in exchange, they offered for cocaine to the Blood and Crips gang, they offered guns and weapons. And then that brought a high price for cocaine when the gang sold it. And in that respect, there's one interesting aspect also. The high price of cocaine also affected children. Some of these are referring to the gangs. Of course, those are usually people without so many attachments, or they're like a cult. And it does affect those poor kids, but it does keep the richer kids perhaps from the drugs. If they're resistant to cocaine, but they did. The CIA should be held responsible. And in turn, the CIA wanted cocaine so they could buy more things to finance the Contras in Nicaragua. And civil wars, he's right, I usually do have more problems with drug sales. But yet we have to remember most of these civil wars are really fought by rebels opposing autocratic regimes like Turkey, for instance. And we're basically, when we invade other countries and control a power elite, that's where the civil war starts. They want a decent living wage.
We just have a really about a minute left, and I appreciate the comments of the caller. I want to get back here to the guest and see if you'd want to make some response to what the caller had to say.
Sure, I do. The thing about San Jose, I'm not an expert on the history of American journalism, but my reading indicates that story has been pretty much discredited, that there was no direct CIA trafficking involved. However, going back to the point that the caller from Urbana made, it is true that the CIA has turned a blind eye to trafficking by certain groups, especially during the Cold War when it suited the interests of the CIA. So there is definitely CIA complicity, but I'm pretty skeptical when it comes to the notion of direct CIA trafficking with Bloods and Crips. That seems a little bit far-fetched to me.
Well, and I think that, I know this is a very contentious subject, but I also believe that the paper actually issued a retraction on the story.
Right.
And backed away from it and the guy who wrote the story. That would, and I, although it's been a long time since I remembered reading anything about this, but it does, I guess, raise in my mind the somewhat related issue that, and it's something that you talk about in the book, the ways in which drugs have been used as means of control by people who go into places and they like to keep the population docile, and drugs have been used in that way, so they are indeed the opiate of the people.
Absolutely. The opiates, plural. And it's not just opium and Chinese laborers, although that's probably history's most famous example. But alcohol and tobacco have been used historically to siphon off the wages of low-income workers and keep them in a state of dependency. There's no question about that. Another connection is between drugs and prostitution. Prostitution is a very difficult line of work. It is emotionally devastating for many women, and they have basically kept themselves going by using drugs. So there are many, many ways in which drugs have been used to control and exploit labor.
The book, as we've said before, is really doesn't really address the issue of control of the use of drugs. Having said that, though, and as a result of your thinking about these issues and writing about it, do you think that you've gained any particular insight into that very question? If indeed there's some drug you decide that we decide or a society decides you'd like people not to use, how it is you get them to stop?
Well, without going into the details of policy, I am convinced that society has every right to regulate drug use. People selling poisons to other people is an industry that is something that should be regulated. I mean, it's like environmental pollution in a way. We don't simply say to industry, oh yeah, pollute the environment as much as you like. And you can think of unrestricted drug commerce as being a means of polluting the human environment. What the tobacco companies did with the expansion of the cigarette industry in the early to mid-20th century is a perfect example of this. So in principle, I'm not opposed to regulation of psychoactive commerce. In fact, I don't see how you could possibly go back to a laissez-faire situation. But, of course, the devil is in the details. And to say that it's all right to regulate is not the same thing as saying, oh, yes, let's have a full-bore drug war. And I think many of the callers were responding to their sense of injustice and excess in the drug war, which sense I share.
We'll have to leave it at that. We want to say, Professor Courtwright, thank you very much. Talking
You're
with
welcome.
Us. Our guest, David Courtwright, professor of history at University of North Florida. The book is Forces of Habit, Drugs and the Making of the Modern World, published by the Harvard University Press.